Welcome to Recalculating America, a program dedicated to small business in America. Recalculating will help you, the American small business owner, build a new business or help you to grow your existing one. Each week, experts will give you useful information about starting your new business, and you will hear from professionals selected to help you grow your business. Your hosts are Don Mazzella and Dan Perkins. Don Mazzella is the editor-in-chief of the Small Business Digest and has many years of experience helping small businesses build and grow their businesses. Now he is sharing his ideas with you over the air. Dan Perkins is a registered investment advisor with 43 years' experience in managing money. He specializes in helping small business owners make their money work as hard as they do. Now, your host, Don Mazzella and Dan Perkins.
Welcome, this is Dan Perkins, and I'm your co-host along with Don Mazzella of Recalculating, a program dedicated to helping small business leaders increase profits. We draw our name from the best-selling book, which features the contributions of more than 100 presidents, experts, and leaders, all of whom offer ways to grow your small business. Don?
Well, Dan, I'm particularly happy today with our guest. This is someone who's come up with a common sense approach to managing companies, and I'll leave that to you to introduce our guest.
Well, good morning, Rex, and thank you for joining us today.
Good morning, and glad to be on the show, and I appreciate what you're doing with small businesses. Having one myself, I'm interested and appreciative.
Yeah, it's a great opportunity, and we can't seem to find anybody else that's doing quite what we're doing, so we're excited about having you here. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got started, and then tell us about your company?
Well, I went through the corporate road. First, I started out as an instructor in the Air Force and did that for 8 years and loved it. I went through the corporate world, and part of that was a stint in corporate training. Even in the Air Force, I was in training, so that was in my blood. And I went away to training, and the company that trained me in a method designed by Dr. Robert Mager, who's a big fish in the little pond of human performance, especially performance in the workplace. And when I left that corporation, I went to work as a consultant, and then 4 years ago got to know Dr. Mager. He lets me use his name and the name of the company. He's long since on to other interests, but I use his name and his method to help companies establish sound business processes and mostly to avoid conflict. The name of the book is called What If Common Sense Was Common Practice in Business? And I focus on just all the violations of common sense that we all see in the workplace and don't even think sometimes to do something about it. And so we lose good people when we could retain a lot more people by taking some simple steps. That's my passion.
Rex, let me get the important thing out of the way. How do people get a hold of you? What's your website address?
The website address, it's a mouthful, so let me say it and then spell it out. It's MagerConsortium.com. Mager is Dr. Robert Mager's name. So the full title is Mager Consortium, Consortium, all of that .com. And then contact us through the website. The book's also available on Amazon.com.
Terrific. We'll put a link to your website on our recalculating.biz website along with your interview so people can get in touch with you. I do have I have several questions, but I want to get your take on what I'm hearing about a particular challenge in the workforce today, and that's specifically dealing with millennials. They seem to have a much more difficult time assimilating into corporate culture today. These are my words. The stuff that I read about them is that they tend to be very self-centered. They seem to not necessarily want to be team players, and they don't want to work a lot, but they want to get paid a lot. So I would guess from a management standpoint, this is probably a huge challenge for a lot of organizations.
Well, it is, Dan. And let me say, you know, I'm a baby boomer, but I'm along there with the millennials, not wanting to work a lot, wanting to get paid a lot. I don't know that that part's just millennials, but I appreciate what you're saying. Millennials do have some characteristics they're known for. I don't know that all the characteristics are bad in the workplace. That the good spin on some of those characteristics are they want to know that what they're doing is relevant. They want to feel like they're giving a contribution. And they want to feel valued and that they're being treated fairly. Now, I don't think millennials are so different than the rest of us in those desires. But what's different is they're a lot more willing than their older counterparts to leave the job if they feel their needs aren't being met. And so the key, if you want to retain millennials, and I have a couple millennials working for me in my small business, and I want to retain them. And regardless of whether or not I like their traits, if I want to retain them, I need to take action to do that.
Well, you made an interesting point that I had forgotten about. Their needs being met perhaps creates more fluidity in moving from job to job. I too am a millennial, and so is Don. We're not millennials; we're the baby boomers. Maybe we wish we were millennials. That particular piece of need, I'm concerned that it's creating a group of people who are going to find themselves leaving a job, maybe not necessarily having a job. They're leaving that job for an emotional and perhaps maybe a ideological reason, may not have a replacement job, and it's better to be out of work than working for a place that's, quote, not meeting my needs. You know, I tell people a paycheck is a wonderful thing. We've got almost 95 million people in this country out of work. We've got 40-plus million people on food stamps. One in five households has nobody working. The idea that I'm going to leave a job because it doesn't fit my needs seems to me to be one of the unique qualifiers of that differentiates the millennials from at least me in my generation.
Yeah, and I'm with you as a baby boomer. And those numbers are just astounding when you think of it, all the human misery that's involved in the numbers you just cited. And, you know, I do with everyone else get a little upset when someone just leaves a job because they think they can do better. But here's the reality we have to deal with that goes along with that. One, if they can get another job and do better, then, you know, then all of the other people that are out of the job become irrelevant to them. And to them, what's relevant to me as a millennial is what sways it. So what I focus on isn't, do I like the millennials' trait or their propensity to leave? It is, if I want to retain them, I need a strategy. And my strategy has become, and this is a result of being over the past 15 years as a consultant, I've been inside over 50 companies. And from the experience of the common experience of that, I realize there are a few things we can do. If we don't do them, they just violate our sense of fairness. And that's why people leave their job, not just millennials. And it is emotional. Dan, you hit on it right on the nosy. Leaving a job is often an emotional decision.
Mm-hmm.
But if we can take that conflict out of the workplace that makes them feel like they aren't being treated fairly, more people will stay. And we can do that rather simply. And no one's talking about it. That's why I get so excited about this subject. If you look at the bottom line or the root to all the conflict in the workplace, not all of it, but the majority of it, we are disagreeing on something that was left to be subjective, open to disagreement. That's what job should be done, how it should be done, how I should be evaluated on that job. That's the source of the conflict. When that's left open to interpretation, inevitably we're going to conflict at some point, and that conflict causes us to not enjoy the workplace as much. When it keeps going on unchecked, we feel like we aren't being treated fairly, and people leave. We can fix that. We can look at work processes and take the subjectivity out of them. That's my message. Whether we like the traits of the people involved or not doesn't really enter into this. Let's just fix it, because it's good business to fix our work processes so they aren't subjective.
You know, I've been in the financial service business for 43 years. I started out as a broker for Merrill Lynch in Columbus, Ohio. And I was fortunate in that I led my class in production the whole time I was a broker before I moved to New York to work in a product area. And there's a training, very extensive training program for brokers, and the big wirehouses have a 6 to 9 month training program where it's a full-time job. And they will invite successful brokers back to New York to talk to trainees about how to become successful in the brokerage business. And you have a resident manager in your office, and then when you go to New York, you also have a resident manager in the training school. And I was talking to him one day, and I said, how did you guys decide to pick me to come back and talk to this training class? And he said, because you were the most successful broker in your class in the country. And we want to make sure that people see and meet people who have started from scratch and built a business and been very successful. But he said to me something that I never forgot. There can only be one number one. And because you're number two doesn't mean that you're not good. But if you always think that every employee thinks that they have to be number one, or they put themselves first, they get an overestimation, and I'm not trying to be critical, I'm trying to be realistic. They get an overestimation of their worth. And when they are not happy with their job and they're going to go get another one, they may find themselves going from the frying pan to the fire. So I think that there is a propensity perhaps of the millennial generation to move on more quickly, more transient. They're less interested in a career, perhaps more in opportunities. Any thoughts about that?
I do, Dan, and I think you've hit it right on the nose. And I think life experience will take care of that feature, that sometimes you leave a job and the grass isn't greener, or you can't get another job. You know, we learn that sometimes the hard way, as millennials will too. But the factor I want to point out, first of all, I'm glad we share the same background. I was in financial services. I mentioned after the Air Force, I went through corporate training. I was in financial services, part of my 18 years there, I spent 8 years leading the training effort of our company. By the way, right now I'm in your old stomping grounds. I'm just about an hour away from Columbus. I'm in New Bremen, Ohio, with Crown Equipment Corporation, a great Ohio company here.
Mm-hmm.
But what I found out, what we did in my financial services company, we had the same practice of bringing people in, and I loved that, and I gained a lot from the people that came in. But what we did that made a big impact, and by big impact, I mean we changed our training program, and it resulted in a 55% increase of the production of new agents, new financial advisors, 55% across the board. That was the average, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
What we did is we took our training program, focused, we did an analysis and said, these are the skills that they lack, and we took the subjectivity out of the training program. That's what turned me on to this whole subject of subjectivity being the root of all evil in the workplace. You know, in sales in particular, there's a lot of subjectivity. We think,
mm-hmm.
well, you know, so some people are born salesmen, and I think there's a lot of truth to that. But the point is, when you train them, there are certain of those skills that we call soft skills that are open to interpretation. There is a process for taking the subjectivity out of that so you can train everybody to have the same skills. Some are going to be more gifted with those skills than others. But the point is, you can take subjectivity out. It makes a huge impact. And I said, well, if we can do that with training, or that's what Dr. Mager did with his career, if we can do that with training, that should apply to recruiting. It should apply to evaluating people. It should apply to developing people when they're on the job. Take the subjectivity out of the processes. Sure enough, it works, and that's why I'm trying to get the word out, because no one else is talking about that. It makes a big impact.
Well, I have some more questions, but let me turn it over to Don and see what's in his percolating in his brain.
Oh, I don't know. You were doing such a great job. I was sitting here. Rex, I want to point out to you, a study came across my desk yesterday that said young people, millennials, whatever you want to call them, are more apt to choose a company because they offered snacks and lunch than any other single factor. Did you want to comment on that?
Other than the fact that, you know, that's I feel like I'm part millennial then, because I like the snacks and lunch too, and I think that's true. But we're talking about a difference here. We're talking about engaging people versus them performing on the job. To engage people, everyone is different. And snacks may not be a big deal to us baby boomers, because while we'd like to eat them, we know we can't afford to eat as many. So that would not engage us. While it may engage millennials, in other words, it may capture their attention, and they may like that company, be more apt to start with it. And that, I think that's completely true. I'm more concerned about retaining people, and that has to do with job performance. And in the case of millennials, in the case of all of us, that has to do with treating them fairly, making sure their evaluations are objective, not subjective, making sure their advancements opportunities are objective, not subjective, so they feel like they're being treated fairly.
I agree with you. But let me, Rex, let me go. I've heard from other people who deal with young people, millennials and others, that they seek greater approval, that they want greater feedback from senior management than older people. Older people seem to be able to be more resilient and on their own, whereas younger people need affirmation not only from above but from side as well. They look to their peers for affirmation. What do you say to that?
I agree with that. I think that is a trait particularly of millennials. Now, all of us, when we're younger, need more approval than when we're older and have a little bit more self-confidence. So some of that is the life experience process. But millennials as a group are a lot more, seem to be a lot more in need of that, especially, as you pointed out, Don, from their peers. And maybe that's because they're in the social network era, where that has been their life. They are more connected with each other. So we can understand that being a trait.
Well, I teach every year at Columbia Journalism School, and I did it last week. And what I was surprised about was that when students got up to ask a question, they looked for affirmation, not from me as to the worth of the question, but from their peers. And I asked them about it. Because I remember, I was just surprised. Before, we used to think that it was our leaders that needed that you wanted it, but they wanted it more from their peers, and I was just so surprised by it.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah, that their peers and those of us that have parented the people that are millennials see that too. How important their friends were over their parents. It was a little bit offensive to us, wasn't it?
Well, let me ask you the other question. We are now in generations. I saw where just in the car building industry, the auto industry, that they had won $30 billion from their annual sales. It was in the Wall Street Journal yesterday. And over the last 10 years, they've in terms of costs, and that a majority of that had come from labor costs. It seems to me then that we seem to be running leaner and meaner. Is that, do you see that as well? And what does that do to your theory, your thoughts?
I'm completely in agreement with that. Leaner and both the leaner and the meaner part. And that's why we can't afford these violations of common sense that we've always just accepted before. We've just accepted that, well, there's going to be subjectivity because people are involved. People are subjective. They are emotional beings. That's why it's so important that the work processes they follow, the way to get things done in the workplace, that's why it's so important that those are objective. So you can do good business with these emotional people and take the emotion out of the critical parts of it, places where people will disagree. We don't want that in the workplace. That's not good business. That's not lean business. That's not appealing to people's sense of fairness. Let's get the conflict out of the workplace by removing the source of the conflict.
I'm going to give it back to Dan, but first, tell us the name of your book again and how people could get it and any other details.
Thanks for that, Don. It's called What If Common Sense Was Common Practice in Business? It's available on Amazon.com. It's available on my website, MagerConsortium.com. And my name's Rex Connor. The subtitle to the book is Don't Expect Fish to Climb Trees. And that comes from a well-loved quote by Albert Einstein, in which he says, everyone's a genius, but if you judge a fish on its ability to climb a tree, it'll live its whole life thinking it's stupid. And that's to bring attention to the fact that we don't do a very good job of making sure people have the right skills, lining up a job requirements with the right skills. And there's an easy way to do that, and that's just one example of common sense in the workplace.
Rex, we've got about 2 minutes, and there's one last subject that I want to raise. So one of the things that I've been reading that's different about the workforce and the millennials is the vulgarity in language. And women are as bad at it as men. There seems to be a decline in civility in the use of profanity on a day-to-day basis. And it seems to me that if we have to use the profanity to express ourselves, our verbal skills are lacking. What do you think?
I think you hit the nail on the head again, Dan. I think there are different ways to express ourselves, and especially in a professional environment, a family environment, a social environment, we should have more tools, more skills, and more of a vocabulary that we can choose to, where in one case, when we hit our thumb with a hammer, we may choose a different vocabulary than when we're talking with each other on the job.
Yeah.
I'm completely in agreement with you.
Dan, let's go a couple of minutes longer because I'd like to ask him another question to follow up that one.
Sure.
Do you think our social interaction skills have been eroded somewhat by the internet? And by that I mean, are we not reading people as well when we see them than we did before, Rex?
Yeah, that's so insightful, Don. And I think it's not just the internet, you know, the whole social media. Our generation calls it a phenomenon. To millennials, it's just the way it is. But anytime in any situation when we are detached from people, and then we're put in a situation where reading those people, interacting with those people becomes critical, like in business. Those are skills that you have to learn interacting with people over time. If you haven't done that because you've been a couch potato, you've been a social media person where you're connecting on the internet but not in person, that erodes those skills, or it doesn't give you a chance to develop the skills. And I have that same concern with some millennials that I work with. you know, I'm trying to get them out to talk with people, and they're resistant because they aren't used to doing that. That's a big concern for me as a small business owner.
Let me follow this up with one last question, then we have to say goodbye to you. One of the things that concerns me, for 18 years, I was a merit badge, a merit badge counselor for the Boy Scouts of America, and I worked in 5 of the merit badges that were required for Eagle Scouts, one of those being communications. And I have to tell you, the influence of the internet and the language of the internet has made young men, even some of the best and brightest, their communication skills and their writing skills are atrocious. And I would think that you would see this not only from what you just talked about with Don on the social side. I think we've got a problem where we have people who can't articulate a thought in a reasonable structure, and that's got to be a challenge for any business, small or large.
It's embarrassing as the business owner when the person that's sending out emails is using their text grammar and their text lack of punctuation. And when they're sending those to other millennials, maybe that's not as bad, but they're sending them to us older baby boomers or Gen Xers and we interpret it as not being very professional. I think that's a big concern. I'm with you, Dan.
Well, Rex, we have to go. Thank you so much for spending time with us today. Give us your website again.
Thank you. It's MagerConsortium.com, Mager, M-A-G-E-R, Consortium, C-O-N-S-O-R-T-I-U-M.com. Thanks so much, Dan. Don, you're tremendous, and the work you're doing is tremendous. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And now we have to pay the bills, so we'll have a word from our sponsor. We'll be right back after these messages.
Hate your old fax machine? You can now fax through email. Simply write an email, attach the document, and send. Works with all major email providers. Get rid of the noisy and expensive old fax machine and try Biscom's Cloud Fax. Our solutions are great for businesses of all sizes. Visit Biscom.com for your free trial. That's BISCOM.com.
Welcome back to Recalculating, a program designed to help you be successful. Now it's time for Money in Motion. Dan Perkins is our resident expert in making the money you earn work as hard as you do. Here is Dan Perkins.
Thank you. Let's talk a little bit about what happened last Friday, and that was the failure of the House of Representatives to vote on a reform of Obamacare, repeal and replace. a lot of people think it was a failure of Mr. Trump. I happen to think it was a very poorly sponsored and a very poorly written piece of legislation. The problem with it, Don, is that when the small business and large businesses were trying to figure out what their health care costs were going to be, they were lulled by the Republican leadership, who for 8 years said if they just got control of everything, they would repeal and replace Obamacare and make it more affordable. They had their chance, and it didn't happen. So now small business people are going to find that their premiums are going to continue to rise, and as a result, their costs to do business are going to continue to rise. Now, there are some people are saying that health care will come back probably in the fall, but that it's dead for now. And I suspect that it probably is dead for now, but it's a setback to the small business person who's trying to be a good steward and provide health care for their employees, but they have no idea what their costs are going to be. And so all the things that we had talked about that this legislation could do with health savings accounts and many other alternatives, catastrophic care policies, none of that's going to happen, at least for now. It's on hold. Now, I was at a conference yesterday, primarily with people from the left, And this one particular woman made a comment that really surprised me, but maybe a prediction. She said that she thought that the failure of the healthcare bill was a positive for Mr. Trump and for the country. And when queried as to why she thought that, she said that one of the things that Mr. Trump has done is engaged people who have not been engaged in the political process, maybe ever. We all heard stories about the people who voted for the first time last fall for Mr. Trump. So maybe as business people and small business people, we can become engaged and letting our congressmen and senators know what it is we're really, really working for, looking for in healthcare reform. But that uncertainty is going to be here probably through the end of the year. Don?
Well, I see our next guest has come on board. But I want to say, you know, Dan, when 2 years ago when we were together on another program, I said that the Republicans had to learn how to govern. They still have to learn how to govern. And hopefully it will happen this time around. I think they'll be I think that they will be very happy come this fall to do it when they hear how the country really wants something done about Obamacare, because you know as well as I do that even the people on the left who support it know there has to be significant changes. I saw a survey yesterday that said that the according to their is from Buy Sell, according to their study of 1,017 small businesses, a majority want some change but do not want repeal. So every study I've seen over the last 3 weeks indicates that small businesses really want some differences. You want to finish up for a minute, and then we'll go to our next guest?
Why don't we, if we've got him, let's go ahead and introduce our next guest, and because it's 32 after the hour, we need to get cracking here.
Okay. Well, Dan, we have Julie Griffin on board. She's an executive with the Mapping Your Future. Julie, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, Judy, we want you to tell us a little bit about yourself personally before anything else, because you have some interesting data and your organization does some interesting things. But first, tell us a little bit about yourself personally.
Well, I actually am based out of Spokane, Washington, so it's a little early in the morning for me, but thank you for having me on. I work for a national organization. It's a nonprofit, Money Management International, and parked under that is Mapping Your Future. So I have this great position in that I get to go out and talk about how to manage personal finances. And for me, this hits pretty near and dear for my household because I have kind of gone through it all myself and can really identify with people who have struggled, who didn't know what direction to go in, because we really lack financial education. So I love the mission-driven work that I do. And so that's a little bit about me, not to take up too much time.
Julie, let me jump in real quick because of something you just said that struck a bell with me. I was a product manager for Merrill Lynch out of New York City, and I traveled all over the country. And I used to do seminars for customers and for prospects. And for larger businesses, I would do a seminar for their entire workforce. And I would ask these three questions. I'd have a bunch of people in the room. The first question I ask: how many of you have a bachelor's degree? And I'd get a raise of hand. How many of you have a master's degree? Raise your hand. Is there anybody in the room who has a doctorate? And some people, small number, would raise their hands. So then the next question I would ask the group of, in all the years that you spent in college, in your advanced degrees, to learn how to make money at a higher paying job, how many hours of credit were you taught on how to manage the money that your success was going to bring? The answer was always zero. We don't teach people how to manage their money.
No, and you make a good point, because it doesn't matter what walk of life you walk and what degree you have, because I have served everybody. They just don't know how to do it.
What is budgeting a big problem?
I would say probably only about 10% of the folks that I work with have a budget and actually work the budget.
Wow.
Those are two different things. Some people have the budget, but they don't actually refer to the budget.
Yeah. Don said that you your company did a survey of, I guess, employees or management. Can you tell us something about your survey and what some of your findings were?
Yeah, so we serve a major hospital system out of Oregon, and they have some rural communities in that mix. And that was why initially over 10 years ago they had us come on board, because those rural communities were really suffering, and they, especially economically. So what has morphed with this particular project was that there was a clear need for financial coaching. And so we started this pilot project about 2 years ago. And so the coach goes in and he works with individuals for just a half-hour increment, because that's about what people can take in and really take action from. So we conducted a survey to see how that coaching went, if people actually took action on their particular goals. And I was actually really astounded by the results, because about 86% of the respondents said, yes, we accomplished goals. We were able to buy houses, we paid down our student debts, we paid down our debts. It was incredible, the results.
Well, Julia, I'm a registered investment advisor, and I've been managing money for individuals for 43 years. And one of the common things that I work with when I work with small business people like myself and Don is that small business people spend almost 100% of their time trying to run and grow their businesses to make it profitable. So they have very little time to run the money that the businesses produce for them. And so they have no real strategy on the investment side of what they're trying to do. They're just trying to make money. And there's only really two ways legally in this country to make money, and that's you at work and your money at work. And this is where I see, as I bring on new clients, the biggest problem is that there is no objective, there's no plan on how you even invest the money that you're able to save. And it's not uncommon, Julie, for me to get a new client that has 8, 9, 10 brokerage relationships, and they have no idea what they're doing. The record for me personally is I had one client who came to me with 29 different brokerage accounts. And I said, your mailbox must be incredibly full each month, because how do you keep track? And they don't. They have a very low skill set of how to decide what to do with their money.
Yeah, and I find that when people really they build these complex systems with their finances, they become very, very stressed, and they really lose all control. And that includes when they have a lot of debt as well. So it's not just the investment side. It's the comfort level with debt and the sheer amount of accounts as well. And they may have the ability to pay the debt, but it just becomes just so cumbersome and having to pay that monthly payment. And sometimes I just look at it and go, I would be extremely stressed if I had to write out that many checks. So part
right.
of it is to help them to simplify their financial lives and really get them on a track of, it's not so much that it's route, but it's just a system that's in place that's easy for them to work, but also with the eye on the future as to what they can do, and with that objective of having their money go out and work for them.
Right.
And I think that's really a foreign concept, like you said, because people are not, we're not raised to think about how we're going to have our money go out and work for us. That just no one ever talks about that component.
Right, right. You know, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to say that oftentimes, so we don't represent we're not financial planners, anything like that. We don't represent a product. So I look at the full opportunity of areas where people can invest, including outside of that 403B and 401K.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, one of the things that I've seen in my practice, and I can't come up with a logical reason why it happens, but it seems to be consistent over the 43 years. People take more risk with their investments than they need to. Let me give you a quick example. If the 50-year history of the total return of the S&P 500 is 7%, and you can go out and buy a preferred stock, it's going to give you 6, and you can reinvest and compound it. Why do you need to take the risk of all of your money invested in common stock to try and get that 1+% more return? So I find that people have a much higher risk profile. What's scary, Julie, is to see people in their 60s who should probably have maybe 30 to 40% of their portfolio in common stock, having 80 or 85% of their portfolio in common stock, and not being able to answer the question, why? Do you do anything on helping people assess risk in general?
Oh, absolutely. It's a key component. And part of that is because we do get so many coaching clients that are about, 5 years or less out from retirement. And sometimes I am absolutely shocked by the fact that they are so high risk.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody steered them in the opposite direction.
Right.
Do you think it's a generational thing? This is what I'm thinking, because what I see with 20-somethings is they are definitely more conservative.
That's possibly true. We typically think of younger people being more interested in risk because supposedly the higher risk produces higher return. And especially the millennials who've seen so many of their contemporaries, probably too aggressive word, some of their contemporaries become billionaires at 30 because they had a particular idea. Excuse me. Do you just do the work in the hospital, or have you branched out?
We actually have quite a few different contracts that allow us to do the financial coaching. And in fact, we do have we do financial coaching with the NFL, so we work with the rookies across the board. So that is a large contract for us. Keeps us on the road.
Oh, Julie, that's Don.
Julie, I don't understand. Who hires you to help the employees? The employer, the employees, individuals, and your nonprofit. Exactly how do you work?
So we have contracts with the employer groups to go out and work with your employees. So it's part of their benefits package.
Mm-hmm. And are small businesses, large businesses, or is there a mix?
For the most part, they're larger businesses.
How many people in your company? I'm sorry, Don. How many people in your company, Julie?
For our nonprofit, there's about 550 people.
550 people in a nonprofit. And you do business nationwide?
Yes, we do.
Oh, and who would be, are you looking for new clients?
Well, we have two different types of clients. So we have the clients that come to us because they're struggling with debt issues, and they're always welcome to call our 800 number to get services, and that's a free service, actually. And then we have the clients who are employers and financial institutions who we work with to provide additional services.
Right.
Yes, we are always looking for new clients.
So what's your website address and what's your phone number?
Our website is moneymanagement.org, And the best way to reach me is directly at 509-242-4205.
Okay.
Repeat
and you...
that again. Repeat that again.
So 509-242-4205.
We'll put that on our recalculating.biz website along with your interview so people can see your web address and your phone number. do you think that it's given the last 8 to 10 years producing minimal returns, virtually earning nothing in money market funds or in the bank in certificates of deposits or money market accounts, has that also caused a toll on the ability of people to deal with the financial situation?
I think it definitely is a disincentive when they actually see their money, they're losing money.
Okay.
Dan, I'd like to ask Julie a question.
Okay.
I read, Julie, that 60% of American families could not come up with $1,000 in an emergency in cash from current. Is that true? And if so, how can families guard against that?
Well, I absolutely believe that's true, given the groups that I've worked with, individuals I worked with. In fact, they have so many debts coming into their household. And that's part of the problem is what we sign up for. How many subscriptions do we have? How many upgrades have we taken on with our cell phone? You know, how many cars are we driving? Part of it's the great American way of spending. And so we can't then make ends meet and we can't put money into a savings. So there's where that budgeting piece comes in. And we've got to go back to budgeting and also stopping the spending. And it's as simple as that. Income piece, yeah, if you can get more income, fantastic. But I don't necessarily want to go work a second job just so I can put that money into savings. I would rather reduce my spending.
Julie, such wisdom that you imparted. We have too much debt. So does our country. Our country has almost $20 trillion of debt. And you know, Julie, most people don't understand how $20 trillion of debt and the debt service, which is about 104% of the total GDP of this country, is put us in tremendous jeopardy. Just as much as the person who has too much personal debt is putting their personal wealth in jeopardy, so are we as a nation. And I think there's a wonderful statement there about understanding debt and not realizing that some things are debt and some other things are hidden debt that we can't see. I think that's very astute on your part.
I thought a few years of listening to people's stories, so over a decade.
Right.
And
Julie,
sometimes I really have to control my facial expressions.
Julie, a close friend of mine many years ago gave me a T-shirt, and it read, I can't be out of money. I still have checks.
Right.
Oh, perfect.
And can I ask you, Julie, is there a strata in terms of ages? Does this trend defy ages and age groups, or are there age groups that are better at keeping their money than others?
You know, I think what was mentioned earlier with the baby boomers, there definitely is an issue with the lack of retirement funds, and you know they have kind of spent that early on in their lives, so they don't have anything set aside. I do see the millennials doing a much better job of preparing and also not spending and going to live their lives a little bit differently. So maybe they're not going to necessarily buy a house early on. Some of that has to do with student loans too, unfortunately. But it's not so much, they're not possession oriented. I'll say they want to live more simple lives, which is pretty refreshing to see.
Well, Julie, we're out of time. We thank you for your...
Well, Dan, well, I'm going to ask her for one more thing. What were the three things that you would ask, would you recommend to, or do you recommend to families when you come across these situations?
I think probably the number one thing is you absolutely have to communicate about money. It can't be hidden. And this includes children within the household. You have to have a constant conversation because this is basically a business that you're running. And you have to identify what you're trying to accomplish and really work towards that. But you have to talk about it. Budgeting is going to be key to that success. And changing your habits or your behaviors and not looking around to see what other people are doing. So in my neighborhood, I live still in a working class neighborhood because I can put my money someplace else. But I've noticed that people started driving really, really nice cars. I'm like, oh, here we go again, because this is what happened the last time. And so you do notice the behaviors of other people, and you start to feel kind of a little bit left behind. But just know you need to stay on track with your own goals and not be worried about what everybody else is doing.
That's the great American concept of keeping up with the Joneses.
Yes.
Thank you, Julie.
Okay. Julie, thank you for being with us today. You've given our listeners great insight. We'll post your website and your phone number on recalculating.biz. And thank you again for coming. And we have a message from our sponsor, and we'll be right back.
Don't let hackers get your data. Email is insecure and can't handle large files. Instead, use Biscom's Secure File Transfer product. Military-grade security that's as easy to use as email, and it can handle attachments of any size. Visit Biscom.com for your free trial and make sure your private communications stay private. That's BISCOM.com.
Welcome back to Recalculating, the program dedicated to American small business. It's time to bring together our two experts, Dan Perkins and Don Mazzella, as they discuss things that are happening now that are affecting your business success.
Well, Dan, we've
yes,
had
sir.
Two very interesting people on our show
yes.
today. What do you think?
Well, I think it was interesting that our first guest was talking about the workplace and how it's changing and how millennials do, in fact, are different. And yet our second guest, Julie, was talking about how she thinks the millennials supposedly a simpler life. They're not going to be necessarily as ostentatious. There's a part of me who wants to believe that, Don, but there's another part of me that's a skeptic in saying, but as they begin to grow in their corporate life and have opportunities for more and more money, I think there's a great possibility they're going to wind up and get trapped just like many other generations of Americans wanting more, bigger cars, bigger houses, faster cars, and will become functionally with gadgets. You know, I saw this little report of 9 ways how to retire as a millionaire. And it was things that you needed to do to control your cost. And it showed, one of them showed to me a lack of true vision on the part of the person who put these 9 points together. And they said, get rid of your car. Okay, I get rid of my car. So how do I get around? How do I get to the grocery store? Do I ride my bike? Or if I want to go to church, do I ride my bike? If I want to go somewhere, I got to rent a car. So the idea that we're going to get rid of our automobile, and that's an expense when you add to that the insurance. But I'm saying sometimes things are not realistic. They're panacea, but they're not realistic. And I think our first guest was trying to be adaptive to the reality of the environment we're living in today and how people work and think and what their needs, goals, and desires are. I can tell you that my youngest son still lives in an apartment. He's got a wife and a child because he's not convinced that this is an appropriate time to buy a house for them to live in. So there are a lot of changes that I'm still wrestling with that the millennials have and what they believe. But, you know, maybe someday I'll figure it out. You, sir?
Well, you know, on that point, real estate people say we're increasingly becoming centered around the railroad stations and places where you can walk. And auto companies are toying with the idea that you will no longer buy a car, but rather buy a share in a car that you would share, right, and you would not own. And in fact, I read a lot yesterday. I read a report that by 2024, more people will buy a share in a car than they will buy a car, according to a report from McKinsey or a similar type company, and that the auto companies are gearing up for that as well. You know, Zipcar, which, you know, is a ride-sharing program, is now has an investment from a major auto company, and in fact, all of them now have tie-ups with companies like that. And the other thing is, the shopping center may be a thing of the past because we simply do not want to travel by car. Who knows? Oh, I do know that from the people I talk to, there seems to be a growing desire, to be closer to things and not travel by car as much, but also, you know, it's ironic. We talk about the boomerang generation of people living with their parents past the age of 21. They seem to be enjoying this, and the only ones who don't seem to be enjoying it are the parents. That may be the generation. I don't know. There's a lot to ponder, and as you and I, excuse me, get a little older and a little further away from this, it's kind of difficult. Maybe we should have somebody on the program who's a futurist to talk about it.
That's probably not a bad idea. I do think, though, that there is somewhat a common thread between our two guests, and I think that one of those common threads is that there's a different value proposition in the millennials than there are of our generation, and the idea that I have to be happy at what I'm doing or feel needed to want to be stroked, to have lunch and drinks and all those things that they're talking about, gratification to justify their own personal needs is somewhat different than what you and I grew up with. And then you have the lack of knowledge of an educated group of people are unsophisticated about what to do with their money and understand debt. And that's been going on for a long time. And so it's there's still a lot of dislocation, still a great deal of uncertainty about what people want to do, where they want to go, and what they're going to do. But I do think that this movement to urbanization, moving to cities, and so that their transportation are minimized, and they can walk to the shopping center, they can walk to the bank, to the restaurants, the sports bars. And they can stay closer to home. And we're just about running out of time. So this is Dan Perkins.
And Don Mazzella.
And thank you for joining us this week on recalculating.biz. And check our website, recalculating.biz, for highlights from our shows today. And we'll talk to you next week.
Thank you for joining us on Recalculating. We hope the information you received on today's show was helpful to you in starting and growing your business. Please go to our website, recalculating.biz, for past shows and special offers. And until next time, remember, if you grow, we grow. Join us next week for more helpful ideas to make your business a great success.